Rewind, your year in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward. Together, that's exactly where we're going to go. God bless
you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is the year-end review version of Rewind, to which we've invited our Henry Cerugi, leader of the Wisconsin I Drum Corps, to walk us down.
We have an entire corps?
Yes, it's Henry. Thank you, Henry, for that intro.
I'm bringing my tom-tom next year. That
please,
be part of it.
I bring fife and drums and everything. In this version, we're going to walk down the 10 most important political stories of 2016. Jay and I have corroborated. We don't disagree on much, if not anything. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Drum Corps, number 10 from the very unofficial and rough vault here. Number 10, JR, redistricting. The U.S. two of the three U.S. Court of Appeals judges ruled that the legislative district lines mm-hmm. drawn in 2011 are unconstitutional. But now let's talk about why it's number 10. Fixes will not be, if fixes are ordered, it won't be till next year. And go ahead, based on what happened yesterday.
This story has a huge potential to become, to rocket up the list in the end for impact. But right now, all we have is a decision of a three-judge panel that hasn't been reviewed by the Supreme Court yet, that hasn't have a remedy implemented yet, that hasn't had a chance to kind of maybe set a national standard for when you say a map has gone too far. And why I say that is, if you go back at past Supreme Court cases, there are lots of examples of the Supreme Court weighing in on maps because of racial gerrymandering or racial representation.
Yes.
You know, we don't have an example in federal court history of, except for this one, of a line that's been drawn where the courts say that's too far for a partisan gerrymander. Okay, if the standard is accepted, and it's a little big if, you could have a national standard for the first time that all maps can be weighed against going forward. That could be a huge, huge deal. Now, what we saw with the latest round of briefs, dueling briefs.
Those were filed yesterday.
U.S. DOJ says, all right, one, lawmakers should have a second kick of the cat if they're going to draw a map, but you should wait till after the Supreme Court does anything
right.
before you order a redrawing of the maps. The Democratic voters who challenge maps say, no, we should start right now, and yes, lawmakers have that power, but you shouldn't give it to them because they already failed once at doing this. You should draw the maps yourselves, and they give a timeline of their what they want to see, deadlines for this done, because they want to have new maps in place for 2018.
Yep.
And their concern is if you delay it all, the U.S. Supreme Court won't get to a decision before June of 2018, which to them is a key mark for having those new maps in place for new elections.
Well, if you have new lines drawn in 2018, they have to be drawn in time for voters to know who the heck they're going to vote for.
So papers be in circulation in April.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's kind of a key time to watch. Now,
it is.
Will that happen? We'll see.
Right.
It's still a high bar to cross before everything gets done, but that could be a huge story.
The old debate on redistricting was called cracking and packing.
Mm-hmm.
The Court of Appeals judges came up with a new standard, the efficiency gap, which we've discussed
yep.
in earlier shows. Okay, Henry, roll it. Number 9. Thank you, Drum Corps. Transportation funding. Assembly mm-hmm. Republicans have drawn their own lines. They've taken on the governor, the leader of their party, and they're taking on conservative Senate Republicans on long-term highway funding. I think this is going to be, you and I agree, toughest nut to crack in the 2017-19 budget.
This is another one that, when it's all said and done, can move up the list for importance. But what we've seen is a stalemate now that's gone on for 2 years. Then go back to the beginning of this budget. You know, the governor proposed $1.3 billion in new bonding. Republicans said, no way, that's too much. Well, what'd they do? They gave $500 million in bonding, but put $350 million in reserve.
Yeah.
And then the Assembly Republicans and the Democratic members of Joint Finance approved releasing that money, so they got to $850. So we're at a situation right now where we're on a pace to have, one out of every $4 in the transportation fund?
22% is what the Assembly Repub's forward package said.
Going to pay off bonding? That's not sustainable.
Yeah.
But what's the solution? They don't have one. If they find a way to solve this problem, this could be another story that goes up list because of the impact.
Oh, I agree.
But there's no way, we don't see right now, and talking to people, a big picture solution to resolve this other than sucking it up, keep the can on for 2 more years and going at it again next time.
Before we hear from Assembly Speaker Voss, yesterday I asked the governor, if the President Trump administration put together a $1 trillion infrastructure package that required a state match, 10%, 15%, 20%, would you consider raising gas taxes or the registration fee to come up with a match? And he said no. So he continues to draw the line in the sand. But earlier this week, I had a chance to do a year-end interview with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on this very subject. Here's what he said. Secretary Gottlieb's statement that the Southeast mega projects would not be complete for 70 years, no new major projects would be planned until 2046, that's unacceptable to you and your caucus.
I think it's unacceptable to the whole state. I mean, let's look at it this way. The freeway system, the interstate system, was built in the 1950s. We are now 70 years later, and they need to be rebuilt. Do you think it's realistic to say we're going to wait another 70 years to rebuild a system that's already at the end of its life? It's like taking a house that's been condemned, saying we're going to keep putting a new roof on it. You need to just look and say, let's tear down the house, start at the beginning, and build one up that can last a lifetime, not just 1 or 2 years every single time.
We're walking down the biggest stories of 2016. Henry, number 8, intro, please. Thank you, doctor. Number 8, John Doe 2 dies. The second probe of Walker and his supporters before the 2012 recall election finally ended when the U.S. Supreme Court refused to allow 3 Wisconsin DAs to revise their probe of the connections that went on before Walker survived the 2012 recall. What PSs?
This thing won't die. This issue won't die. Yes, the Supreme Court said we're not taking it up. But now we have the Attorney General, talked to him last week, said he is planning to investigate the leaks to the Guardian newspaper of John Doe 2 documents. He's looking at impaling a grand jury to do that. We have this week Assembly Org, the Community Assembly Organization, voting along party lines to authorize the AG to investigate this.
Which amounts to them telling him to do. Go ahead, excuse me.
So this thing just won't go away. And the question I have is, at what point does it end? When is the final straw going to be drawn that on this thing that just finally collapses, goes away, whatever? It could be a while yet. And the thing is, John Chisholm, he won re-election as a DA. They targeted him, the conservative groups did, because of the John Doe stuff. So he's still there. This is still going on. Will we be like talking about this next year's year in review about the John Doe finally going
away? Maybe, because, well, the one that's coming up next, I think, is going to be a big issue in the 2018. Okay, number 7. Lincoln Hills. Now, you know, 18 months ago, very few of us in the Capitol knew much about the state's juvenile prison north of Wausau, Lincoln Hills. And then I looked it up. On December 5, a year ago, there was a raid by state and federal officials, promised a federal investigation. 1 year later, no criminal charges, but you've had this steady drip of good journalism documenting dysfunction and injuries at Lincoln Hills. Now, here's my prediction, JR. This becomes a pretty big issue in 2018 election for governor. Agree?
Yes. And the other thing is, will there be charges? What will be the result? Who's doing what? It's been kind of confusing to follow some of the post-mortem or the year-end stories about where things stand with this, about exactly where we're at. Are charges possible? Who might get charged? But that could be another great impact story when it's all said and done.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, coming up on number 6. Photo ID to vote. You know, if you look back, after Republicans took control of the Capitol in 2011, this was one of their priorities. Fast forward 5 years, don't use the term fast forward, because you've had lawsuits, court orders, injunctions, but I think the history here and why you and I rank it as number 6 is, for the first time, Wisconsin voters to vote for president had to show a photo ID. Mm-hmm. But one of the lawsuits is still pending. So,
federal judge James Peterson is not happy and has not been happy with the appeal process, essentially, is what it is. If you lack the documentation to get an ID, you have to have a way to get a free one, right? That's part of the requirement to make it constitutional. The appeal process, according to him, is not fair, not done right. How do we fix that? That's the lingering question for this, and will be for a while. He put off ordering some fixes till after this election, give him some time to figure some things out. The other thing is, what's the impact of photo ID? We may see, there'll be some studies that we've heard about, people are undertaking right now to see what the impact was. Now, if you look at Milwaukee County, for example, in the presidential race, there was a drop-off in turnout in Milwaukee County compared to 2012. Now, there are some reasons why that probably happened. Hillary Clinton failed to inspire the African-American community the way Barack Obama did, obviously. But some critics of photo ID are saying it was because of the impact of photo ID. Could have had an impact? Sure, possibly. Was it widespread? We won't know. These studies may show it, they may not, but there's still some postscripts written on that story before it's all said and done.
And I believe there's a group of professors at the UW-Madison that are doing an in-depth study, the potential effect of having a photo ID on the people, the voters that you just mentioned.
And the next thing is, President-elect Trump has made a lot of noise about early voting laws. There was a lawsuit overturned the restrictions on early voting limits. Will we see a new round of legislation that tries to rein things back in? That's kind of another thing to watch as 2017 goes along.
Okay. Okay. Number five. Well done, Doctor. Number five, the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's here because two developments. Number one, David Prosser resigned. He's a former Outagamie County DA, maybe Winnebago. Mm-hmm. Then he became a member of the Assembly. Then he became Assembly Speaker. Then he became a Tax Appeals Commissioner. Then he was put, Governor Thompson put him on the Supreme Court.
He won re-election in 01 with no opposition. 11 became a de facto referendum on Act 10.
Yes.
Then there was the fallout of the physical altercation with Justice Bradley.
Yep.
And now his retirement. It's been quite a couple of years with him.
Well, he had a public service career of 39 years, and he left the court with this unresolved ethical complaint about the incident with Justice Bradley. He was replaced by Milwaukee attorney Daniel Kelly. But in April, let's not overlook the fact that another Walker appointee, Justice Rebecca Bradley, beat Court of Appeals Judge Joanne Kloppenburg. I think the takeaway, why this is on our list for number five, is conservatives have held on to the critical majority on the Supreme Court.
Oh, absolutely. Rebecca Bradley, few people would argue she's not more conservative than Justice Crooks was, who she replaced. I think she's definitely moved the court to the right philosophically. Daniel Kelly, his kind of career remains to be seen how he's going to be as a justice, but the thought of him being appointed to the court was that he was going to be a thought leader, that the attraction for Governor Walker appointing was he would be somebody who would be like a voice like Antonin Scalia with the U.S. Supreme Court, a big thinker, if you will, of conservative ideals. So it's moved the court to the right. We don't have a challenger yet for Justice Annette Ziegler. That's something to watch, another conservative member of the court. It's really kind of fascinating to watch how that court has changed in the last 10 years from where it was before.
Absolutely.
And look at Justice Rebecca Bradley's retention bid. It was an ugly race. There are a lot of things about she wrote in college that came out that were not pretty, sullied some people on her, and it was a great comeback story for her to rebound from that and win, partially because we had a presidential primary on the ballot in which Republicans were more motivated to vote from that primary than Democrats were. That probably helped a great deal in her retention.
I want to come back to something you said. You're not hearing any names as potential challengers for Justice Ziegler?
Not so far.
Well, that's your business.
The deadline is the first Tuesday in January, which is rapidly approaching.
Wow.
Hmm?
Okay. Yeah, we're closing in on that. Okay, number four. I love it. The April presidential primary. Let's think about who won that. Texas Senator Ted Cruz won, followed by a gentleman named Mr. Trump, followed by Ohio Governor John Kasich. And on the Democratic side, a senator named Bernie Sanders beat Secretary Clinton. That was very interesting. Well, let's listen to the victory speeches of Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Bernie Sanders.
Tonight is a turning point. It is a rallying cry. It is a call from the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin to the people of America. We have a choice. A real choice here in Wisconsin, a state that just 3 weeks ago the media had written off. Of 3 weeks ago, the media said Wisconsin was a perfect state for Donald Trump. But the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin stood and campaigned tirelessly to make sure that tonight was a victory for every American.
It has been projected by, I think, all of the networks that we won in Wisconsin. Momentum is starting this campaign 11 months ago, and the media determining that we were a fringe candidacy. Momentum is starting the campaign 60 to 70 points behind Secretary Clinton. You look at statewide polls, we are defeating Donald Trump by very significant numbers. With our victory tonight in Wisconsin, we have now won 7 out of 8 of the last caucuses and primaries.
Jay, I really enjoyed those clips because you had Senator Cruz in the back, Representative Adam Nyland, but you also had CNN flashing the percentages. Cruz 52, Trump 29, and John Kasich 15. And then you had Senator Sanders claiming victory with 53% to 46%. What are your thoughts? What are your memories about the April presidential primary?
Well, so many seeds of what happened in November were sown in April in some ways. One, on the Democratic side, there wasn't the enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton that there was for Bernie Sanders, and that carried over into November. She hit her numbers in Dane County that Barack Obama did, but not in Milwaukee County, definitely not in the Fox Valley, definitely not outstate, north and west. There was a lack of enthusiasm for her. She did not
seen in Kenosha.
She did not connect with people the way that Sanders did, and that was part of the problem. On the Republican side, it's fascinating to watch. We were the last stand of the Never Trump movement.
Thank you.
Really, we were. You had a coming together of kind of the establishment, talk radio in Milwaukee, starting with Charlie Sykes' interview with Donald Trump, which was a complete meltdown for Donald Trump.
I think it ended with Mr. Trump saying, "Have a nice day."
But then the turnaround, and part of what happened in November was that Trump still did poorly in Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, compared to Ron Johnson. So, you know, in a way, Trump would have done, if he had had a better showing here in April, maybe he would have had an easier time winning Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Then you had the tangent of Charlie Sykes never coming around the Never Trump movement. Others did. Other talk show hosts did. Charlie did not. He left this week, sticking true to the Never Trump cause. Lost some audience because of it. It kind of talked about being excommunicated a little bit from the conservative cause. But really, it was fascinating to watch how what played out there, how it went from that, from Trump getting what, a little more than a fourth of the vote in the primary to winning the state.
29% in April.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And Sykes is now writing a book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. Mm-hmm. Okay, number three. Oh, I like that. Bigger GOP majorities in the legislature beginning in the session that kicks off here within a few days. So now the Assembly Republicans are up to 64-35. Mm-hmm. You and I didn't expect that.
No.
And the Senate Republicans are 20-13. They picked off, the Assembly picked off Chris Dano. He was 4 terms. The Senate Republicans picked off Senator Julie Lassa, which I didn't see coming. Mm-hmm. Maybe you did. So this, well, is there such a thing as having too much of a majority, JR?
It's harder to manage Robin Voss's caucus now that we're 55, 53. I've heard the theory from a lot of Capitol veterans that when you're around like low 50s, there's more of a team mentality of you can't go off on your own because you have to be there for the team. You know, if there's 51 votes and you vote no, then every person is the deciding vote on that bill. So it's a little bit more of a kind of a cohesion there.
Yeah.
At 64, not only do you have people going, well, I can vote no and doesn't matter, you also have people going, well, if not now, then when? So a lot of the ideas that you're going to hear, or not say a lot, but some of the ideas you're going to hear this next session will be, well, we're in the charge. Let's see what we can do with this thing. What can we get done? Can we do a prevailing wage repeal, a full repeal of prevailing wage? Can we repeal the minimum markup? Can we push concealed carry on campus? Can we push a fetal tissue bill? What can we get done with the majority? And so for leadership, part of the challenge now is what do you want to let through and what do you want to try and beat back before it reaches the floor?
Well, it's very interesting. When you look at Senate Republicans, a lot of them are pretty new in their careers in the Capitol. LeMahieu, mm-hmm. Roth, and now you have Senator Fein, and now you have Pat Teston, mm-hmm. who took out Lassa. So it's going to be interesting how much they take their lead from the Senator Fitzgerald and the ones that have been there a while.
Will Fitz still be around? Remember, he's still waiting. We're still waiting to hear if he's going to get a job in the Trump administration because he was one of the early ones in the Trump train. That's still a possibility. You know, the going vibe in the Capitol is it has to be something good. He's going to go out there to be like an attaché to somebody. You know, the going joke is Ambassador to Ireland. If he gets that, he's gone in a heartbeat. But will Fitz leave? That's going to be a big thing to watch.
And if
caucus.
He does, then Senator Bookmeer, who's now the Assistant Majority mm-hmm. Leader, you and I have heard the discussion of her thinking about running against Democratic Senator Baldwin next year.
Yep, we'll see about that.
She'd have a big decision.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Majority Leader or lay the groundwork to challenge Senator Baldwin. But we do have the biggest GOP majorities in decades. Number two. Thank you, Drum Corps. Republican Senator Ron Johnson trailed in the polls. Do you remember polls 16 months ago when 33 to 38% of those said didn't have enough information or didn't know? Then you skate that out to November 8th, and he wins. He gets 74,000 more votes than Donald Trump. What's going on?
A couple things happened. One, Russ Feingold was assumed to be like this undefeatable character going in, right? Because he'd been a senator before, he had higher name ID, he had higher positives. People talk about in 2020 he lost. He still had a net positive, you know, view from people. But what happened is that Russ Feingold represents what people didn't want in this election. They wanted change, and he was more of the same. He was somebody who'd been in the Senate for 18 years, who'd had a 30-plus year career in politics. He was not change. Ron Johnson successfully projected an image of somebody who was change, even though he'd been senator for 6 years, somebody who was not part of the establishment. What's really interesting is there's some mistakes made by the Feingold campaign. You talk to people that in August, Ron Johnson looked like he was dead in the water. I mean, granted, the polls have been bad for him most of the year. But in August, he split up with his media consultant. Yeah. He was off the air. Trump was doing poorly post-convention. It looked like it was bad for him. There was a time there that they could have really gone in to find Ron Johnson and knocked him back. Instead, Feingold chose to run the campaign he'd been running all along, which was kind of a safe campaign of, I'm assuming that Hillary Clinton's going to win Wisconsin. I'm assuming that I'm going to be, you know, be good Democratic turnout. That will be like we usually see, and I should win by a couple, 4 points no matter what. Instead, Johnson began to lay the foundation of building up his name ID, went back to the whiteboard ad, ran an ad about helping a couple adopt a child from Africa, about the Joseph Project in Milwaukee. He really tried to humanize himself, and he kind of captured that move. Now, there's a debate about who helped whom. Did Trump help Johnson in places like Trumbull County where Chris Dano lost? Or did Johnson help Trump? Or were they both mutually beneficial in the state GOP with a great ground game, helped everybody? That's a question.
But I got asked this over lunch today. Why did the third-party groups that can spend and do spend millions, and their third-party independent efforts, they had washed their hands of Johnson. And I was asked today, why did they get back into it?
A couple of things. One, there was one group, one and a half, who stuck around, Reform America Fund. That group still was running ads in September when things weren't looking so great for him. There is the pro-Johnson super PAC, Let America Work, who did some things, but if you look at their spending, they weren't spending big money. Reform America, which also had Reform Wisconsin Fund, they're kind of tied. They were doing stuff. They kind of kept things going a little bit. Johnson had a great plan. And then at the end, there was an opportunity to come in and help. Part of why they came in was because they realized they made a mistake. The NRSC pulled out and said, okay, you're kind of on your own. They realized you can't really do that to somebody. The chamber said, holy smokes, there's a chance here to help. And they want to be part of the win. Because if you're Johnson, do you go, you know what? You abandoned me. Do I really want to like help you now after you like left me for dead? Unless you come back. Maybe it helps smooth some things over. We'll see. But, you know, Ron Johnson's got to feel like, hey, I don't owe anybody anything.
When President-elect Trump came to West Dallas for his thank you tour, this is the explanation that Ron Johnson gave about how he won. Let's listen to this.
I'm here just to say thank you. The only reason Harry Truman became president because six Senate Democrats outperformed him on their state ballots. That established the goal for myself. And I conveyed that goal to every Lincoln Day dinner, every party gathering, every victory center, that don't worry about what everybody else says. Don't worry what's happening around the country. We've got a job to do here in Wisconsin. And we did it. This Senate seat got more votes than any other Republican statewide candidate in the history of the state. That's what you did. Your tireless efforts.
Now, JR, here's my question. Johnson is back in the Senate. But if President-elect Trump, if President Trump floats a $1 trillion infrastructure package and doesn't pay for it, Johnson is the one. You've seen his talking points, $19 trillion deficit, $20 trillion deficit. Will someone like him, do you think, go along with the infrastructure package if it's not paid for?
That's an excellent question, how they're going to react. It's been fascinating to watch a couple of national media stories this week about Republicans being afraid to take on Trump because of the backlash you get, not only because Trump has a huge Twitter following, but the conservative media, who's on his side, like the Breitbarts of the world, who will go after you if you don't fall in line with Donald Trump. So will we see Republicans with, say, you know what, the heck with it, I'm not going to go along with this? Will they bow down to his desires? I mean, Paul Ryan doesn't want to pass $1 trillion infrastructure package without paying for it in some way, shape, or form, you know? But how will they work? How will they work together? That's another big thing. You know, Ryan was not a fan of Donald Trump for much of the year. He disinvited him from a rally in October.
Fairgrounds, yes.
A month and a half later, he's at the Donald Trump victory party, yeah. You know, looking at him glowingly because he sees an opportunity now. We can get things done. Paul Ryan has a whole list of priorities, what he wants to do with the idea-driven campaign that he's going to run. He can implement them now. Will Donald Trump go along with that? Paul Ryan wants to tackle entitlements. Will President Trump tackle entitlements? I don't know. I mean, Trump basically said, don't mess with that stuff. That's disaster.
Well, I remember Johnson said, I am the only manufacturer in the U.S. Senate. How will that manufacturer reconcile some of the potentially aggressive spending from the Trump administration? It's going to be a fascinating issue.
And what about trade? I mean, Donald Trump's made clear that he wants to go after companies that move jobs overseas. Will people go along? Will Republicans go along with that? That's counter to the GOP ideology.
And remember, Johnson never told voters how he stands on that major trade pact.
TPP.
TPP. Thank you. Okay. Captain Drum Corps, number one. Thank you. This is great. Number one, Donald Trump wins Wisconsin.
What else could it have been?
What else could it have been? Ta-da. First win by a Republican in 32 years. A lot of people didn't see it coming. So, JR, talk about that.
It's interesting talking to lawmakers who did doors, the feedback they got on Trump. Some people will tell you, Republicans, that when they do doors, they didn't bring him up because you'd either get somebody who'd yell at you if you weren't fully on board or yell at you if you were kind of on board. But Donald Trump tapped into the unease in Wisconsin and other places about the economy. There are a lot of folks who are blue-collar workers who have high school degrees but no advanced education beyond that, working good jobs, going, my job isn't secure. What am I going to do? They blame trade policies for these jobs going away. What's going to happen now? Will Donald Trump be able to preserve those manufacturing jobs, bring jobs back from Mexico? We'll see. Now, he went out of his way with Carrier, Indianapolis. The more we find out about that deal, maybe the less good it is if you're a free market economist type person. But that was a big political win for him, right? He showed he can go in there and step in. What else will he do? What policies can he put in place to try and help not just one company, but a lot of companies? There are people who argue it's already too late for some of these companies. It's not trade, it's automation. These jobs are going away because it's cheaper to have a robot than it is a person long term. So what happens on trade? It's going to be fascinating to watch if these folks who voted for Trump feel like, hey, in 2 years he delivered. Now, drain the swamp. He's got three people from Goldman Sachs in his cabinet potentially, if they're confirmed. Is that getting
the cabinet
away from
you saw the news story, worth $15 billion?
Mm-hmm. Is that getting away from the message? Or if they deliver on tax reform, if they deliver on trade policy, if they deliver on immigration, will that be enough to go, you know what? Yeah, he brought in a bunch of people who are not traditional, cabinet picks, but we don't care because we feel better about things. What's going to happen? That's a huge thing to watch because the president's party in the midterms often has a bad election midterm. Republicans run everything in Washington, D.C. right now. They run everything in Wisconsin right now.
Yeah.
Will they get blamed if things don't go well? And if Trump doesn't do well, will state Republicans get blamed for Trump? I mean, we saw that in 06 with George Bush having the Iraq War. I was just talking to somebody recently about doing lit in 06 where Republican state senators, like their campaigns, were getting grief about the Iraq War. It's like, we had nothing to do with it. Didn't matter. They're the same party as the president. That's something to watch. Same thing with Obama and 10 with Obamacare.
Well, one of the reasons that it's so significant, and number one, another reason why it's so significant is you have the Oval Office to Reince Priebus, mm-hmm. to Paul Ryan, Speaker, to Governor Walker, who's saying bring on the reforms, to the GOP majorities in both houses of our legislature saying we want turn Wisconsin into a laboratory for your reforms, President Trump.
The other thing is we've been told for couple decades now that in Wisconsin, when we have presidential level turnout, Republicans can't win statewide. It's just not possible. There are too many Democrats come out to vote. Yes, they can win at 2.1 million, They could win in a recall election with 2.2 or 3. They could win in 14 at 2.5. Now they've won at 3 million voters. Now what else can you say? Is Wisconsin been realigned fundamentally from a purple state that leans a little red, more red-purple in an off year, a little more blue-purple in presidential year, to being a red state? I mean, you still see signs that no, but you can't help but acknowledge the win streak Republicans have the last few years. Obama seems like now like the aberration, not the rule in Wisconsin.
And the implications for Democratic Senator U.S. Tammy Baldwin in 2018, fascinating.
Oh, hey. She, by the way, is the one Democrat who may have a silver lining out of 2016, because if she were running with very popular President Clinton in 2018, it would be a very tough environment. But if there's a very unpopular President Trump in 18, she had a much better chance.
Yeah, but you and I, in the first rewind in January, we'll talk about some of these 2017 issues. Before we close this show, what are some things on our honorable mentions list? We had a first-time politician in the 8th District in
Mike Gallagher
winning as a Republican in the 8th District. We had the startup of the new Ethics and Elections Commissions. Anything else come to mind as honorable mentions?
What happened? What month is this again?
How about corporate donations? This was the first
cycle. The real campaign finance law. It's been interesting to look at the reports and see the changes. The caucuses were raised pretty good money off of that. Another impact, Governor Walker, and talking to him this week, you know, he knows he's got to raise some money to show people serious about 2018. The rules have changed. It used to be a $10,000 limit. Now he's got $20,000 limit. That's going to be easier to raise big chunks of money. It's a different world than it was before.
And Governor Walker isn't on our list, although he is sounding more and more like he's going to seek a third term in 2018, right?
Well, I think part of it, he has to stay relevant. You know, if Governor Walker, we all think, wants to run for president again. The question is, when will that window be open? He will tell you many times he could wait 20 years and still be younger than the current president-elect,
yes,
third presidency.
Then Secretary Clinton.
But the farther away he gets from 2011 and Act 10, the less of an argument or a story has to tell to primary voters in a presidential race.
And he needs to be a governor to have a base to stay relevant nationally in debate.
And so watch this budget. What powers do they give? Does D.C. give to the states? I talked to Governor Walker for our year in an interview. He talked about heavy-duty reform for a welfare program.
Yep.
What's that mean? He's talking about expanding drug testing possibly beyond childless adults to others. What more requirements do they implement? What can they do creative? What with Medicaid? You know, what's going to happen with that if they do block grants
for Medicaid? Block grant. I just don't think they're going to block grant to have an impact in the next budget, 2017-2019.
But the possibilities are endless right now, and he sounds like he wants to run.
Okay. Before I ask Henry Cerruggi to take us out, I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind Year in Review. Take us out. All right. Thank you.
Rewind Your Year in Review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.